The community challenged me to become more aware of Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael and to understand the importance of religious Zionism. Mr. Weiss, do you remember?
No.
No? That's probably why I enjoyed the Yom HaAtzmaut Kiddush.
Okay.
Yeah, it's all good. Okay, so this year we began a series, a three-parter, actually, to help us understand some of the history and some of the excitement, some of the issues that have been coming up in regard to what I call American religious Zionism. Last week we met Reverend William Blackwell, who probably is the father of American religious Zionism, even though, as we pointed out, sort of tongue-in-cheek, his religion was not necessarily ours, but he certainly pushed a doctrine that had a tremendous amount of effect on the Jewish community in the United States at the time. Tonight, I want to focus on the second character, who also had a tremendous impact on religious Zionism. He's going to introduce us to a world that we know very well, that continues to exist until today, called the Mizrahi Movement. And next week, please God, we will be able to deal with the last figure without whom we cannot discuss religious Zionism in the United States of America, and that will be when we talk about Rabbi Soloveitchik. And in that regard, next week we'll focus on the fact that Rabbi Soloveitchik had to overcome a major philosophical and familial hurdle, and he did, to identify. And boy, once he moved from his previous family position, boy, did he go. But speaking of rabbinic people who had to overcome physical and familial ties, tonight we're going to discuss Reb Meir Berlin. Who is Reb Meir Berlin? By the end of the class, you will not be referring to him as Reb Meir Berlin. Instead, you will refer to him by his better-known name, Reb Meir Bar-Ilan, right? The namesake and theoretical founder of Bar-Ilan University. Reb Meir Berlin was born in 1880 in Volozhin, Russia. Volozhin was the grand home of the granddaddy of the yeshiva movement. And Reb Meir Berlin was born in Volozhin. He was the son of Raina Batya Epstein, who was the sister of Rav Baruch Halevi Epstein, known as the author of the Torah Tamima. But more importantly, she was also the second wife of Rav Naftali Tzvi Yehuda Berlin, otherwise known as the famous Netziv, the final Rosh Yeshiva of Yeshivas Volozhin. And so it's interesting, he had an older brother. His older brother has a yeshiva in Brooklyn named after him. It's known as Yeshivas Rabbi Chaim Berlin. Maybe you've heard of it. It was Rav Huttner's yeshiva, Rav Chaim Berlin. And the age gap between Rav Chaim Berlin and his son, and his brother Meir, anybody know? Rav Chaim Berlin was 40 years old when his brother Meir was born. The Netziv had two sons from two different wives, Raina Batya being the younger one. And he was, and the Netziv was one of the great tzaddikim who changed the course of Jewish history. You may remember when we were covering some of the Zionist, anti-Zionist work, when we were looking at the Ukraine situation, where the Netziv's name came up because the Netziv was a very atypical Rosh Yeshiva. He was very supportive of the Zionist efforts. He was also the last Rosh Yeshiva of Volozhin, because Volozhin was closed down by the Russian government in 1892. What exactly happened that caused the shutdown of the Volozhin yeshiva? Boy, we could spend a lot of time in another series about that. What was thought to be the reason, after opening of Russian archives, may actually not have been the reason. What was thought to be the reason for many, many years throughout history, since 1892, was the fact that the Russian government was opposed to the religion. And of course, there were different elements within the yeshiva who were understood to be interested in a more open environment. And the Russian government exploited that openness to demand that the yeshiva be primarily a university, with devoting most of the learning hours of the day to secular study and leaving maybe an hour or two for religious study. This was always the long-standing theory when we talk about Volozhin Yeshiva. More modern, since the collapse of the former Soviet Union, some of the KGB archives were opened, and it has been suggested that perhaps it was also because there were certain elements in the yeshiva at the time who were communist, right? And were not exactly pro the great. They were seditious bent, and so the government stepped in order to shut it down, to try to prevent an environment where you had a number of young men who were around who should not become rebellious in the process. I don't know. We can spend some time debating both ends of the historical issue. Whatever it was, then the Tziv was forced to close the yeshiva in 1892, and he dies within 2 years in 1894. Now, our subject tonight, Reb Meir Bar Ilan, was actually 14. He was 14 at that point in time in his life. You contrast that with his brother, Reb Chaim Berlin, who was 54. You see a very big difference. When you lose your dad at 14, it's very different than when you lose your father at 54. In theory, they say that the Reb Meir Bar Ilan was quite influenced by his father's deep commitment to settling the land of Israel, and certainly he wrote a tremendous amount about it. And even when Zionism was being debated between secular and religious Jews, he came out very much in support, both in writing and in his commentaries, supporting the settlement of Eretz Yisrael. And when the Netziv died in 1894, so Reb Meir Bar Ilan starts to travel from yeshiva to yeshiva. First he travels to Telz, then he travels to Brisk, then he travels to Nevardik, and he learns with his grandfather on the other side, Rabbi Chil Mechel Epstein, the author of the Aruch HaShulchan, and he proceeds and gets smicha at 22 years old. This is Reb Meir Bar Ilan. And in order to, at 22 years old, he decides, gee, I gotta go further my studies. And so if you're 22 years old, you already have achieved smicha, and you want to become more knowledgeable, what do you do? Well, the character we're going to meet next week certainly had his position clearly identified, and that was he went to Berlin. And so did Reb Meir Bar Ilan. Reb Meir Bar Ilan, at 22 years old, travels to Berlin, to Germany, where he becomes very influenced by the religious community, and in particular the doctrine of the German community at the time, which was Torah im derech eretz, the understanding that Torah has to also come with a livelihood, with a process of being able to synthesize traditional Jewish law and Jewish Torah study together with the modern culture of the time. And so in Germany, Reb Meir Bar Ilan becomes very active in the daily affairs of life, but also in the affairs of the Zionist community, and within the Mizrahi in particular. And so in 1905, this young man, Reb Meir Bar Ilan, starts participating for the first time as a delegate to the Zionist Congress, which was taking place all over Europe at the time. Every year, there were a number of these groups that were meeting together. And one of the major issues that came up in 1905 for the Zionist movement was the idea that had been raised by Herzl and others as to where the Zionist homeland should be, because there was an offering of a little country in Africa known as Uganda, and Bar Ilan turns around and he goes, no, you can't go ahead and take over Uganda. And just like we saw with William Blackwell last week, we see it now in the religious community, the Orthodox Jewish community. Reb Meir Bar Ilan also votes against the Uganda plan because he's convinced that Eretz Yisrael was the only possible homeland for the Jewish people. And so from this point on, Reb Meir Bar Ilan devotes his entire life and all of his activities to develop the idea of the Mizrahi party in the Galut, and ultimately in Eretz Yisrael. And so in 1911, he realizes he's a writer, he's a scholar. So what's he going to do? Make big conferences? Throw circuses? That's not going to be his way. And so he finds the first Hebrew weekly newspaper called Ha'ivri. And it became recognized as an open forum where a lot of religious Zionists and other Zionists expressed the very grave and realistic questions which faced the Zionist movement at that time. It also served as a basis for literary articles written on Zionism. And so he officially didn't have a title in 1911. Reb Meir Bar Ilan becomes the Mizrahi's traveling spokesman, and he's traveling from country to country all over Europe to do what? To go ahead and help them establish their Zionist efforts. And so in that regard, Rameir Bar-Ilan discovers he's fighting a two-sided battle. What's the two-sided battle? He uses his Bar-Ilan Berlin name, that is to say, one against the religious sectors which reject Zionism in totality, and here he is, the son of the Netziv, and he's able to argue. And on the other side, he represents the religious community against the secular Zionists, who threaten the entire future of the religious factions within the Zionist movement. And we saw that when we were talking about Pinsker, how Pinsker also worked very, very hard, coming from the other angle, to help the Russian and Ukrainian elements of Zionism even include a religious Zionist element. And so when they ask Rameir Bar-Ilan about this, he describes the German Western Europe experience as one of the fact that it was organizational waiting, he says. In other words, if the time was right, the people would be swift, because the people in the, as a whole were open to Zionism and the idea of organized Yeshiva Aretz. Europe, Western Europe, was a very organized place, and the Jewish communities in each of these places all had something called the Kehillah model. It's always got to be a reference to the Kehillah somewhere, right? So they have this Kehillah model that they have for themselves, and he realizes in this regard, Rameir Bar-Ilan, that as far as Europeans are concerned, you know, it's a pretty simple system. At some point, they're going to hit a breaking point, and they're going to say to themselves, okay, now we just have to flip over and carry this model to Israel, and we'll be able to establish the Zionist movement. It'll be an organized movement, and people will be able to function absolutely beautifully. And so recognizing that the delegates he's meeting at these regular Zionist conferences, he discovers that there's a small group of very young people there. They come from this foreign non-European country called the United States of America. And he discovers that they don't really have any sort of organization back home in the United States. So Rameir Bar-Ilan steps in, and the Zionist Mizrahi leadership realize, if we don't get any sort of presence on the ground in the United States, we're going to lose the footing in the New World. The entire Western Hemisphere is going to be lost to the efforts of Zionism. And so, therefore, they decide they have to send their local delegate. Who's the one who they send? They say, hey, Rameir Bar-Ilan, why don't you travel to the United States? So Rameir Bar-Ilan travels to the United States, and according to his biographers, already on the trip over to the United States, he sees what the great challenge is in front of him. Remember, you're talking at a dawn of of World War I. You're talking about people traveling by ship. You're talking about people who are traveling when immigration policies were first being loosened up in the United States and really very much held to a trickle. So if people were able to escape Europe to head to the New World, they were not exactly looking to be religious Zionists. And so while he's on the ship, Bar-Ilan already sees that the immigrants who are traveling with him...
corner spinach.
Right.
Corner spinach.
Okay, Mr. Weiss, we're going to mute you for a second, okay? So they discover that... they discover that on the ship already, he sees the people who are traveling to the United States, they're not really so excited about being religious at all. And they tell him, you know, they're more interested in doing what? They're more interested in the freedom of America. And so he knew he had a lot of work to do at that point in time. And so in 1914, he spends the first couple of years. And in 1914, he decides, you know what he's going to do? He's going to make the first Mizrahi conference in the United States of America. Now, he's just sitting around trying to figure out, where in the United States do I want to make this conference, right? And so he says, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to go right to the hotbed of anti-Zionism. Where is the hotbed of anti-Zionism in 1914 in the United States of America? Anybody? Surprise of surprises, it's Cincinnati, Ohio. Why? Why Cincinnati? Nobody would have thought that. You're thinking maybe New Square, you're thinking maybe Williamsburg. But you have to remember, in 1914, Williamsburg had a very active melting pot community. And there was, and New Square was a bunch of fields, right? What's in Cincinnati? Cincinnati is the home base of the Reform movement. The Reform movement has one of its important doctrines, it is not a Zionistic movement. And so Bar-Ilan thinks to himself, first of all, it's the Central United States of America. And second of all, he says, hey, I'm going to do this, and I'm going to try to show everybody that there's room for Zionism and religious Zionism everywhere. And so he goes into Cincinnati, and he discovers that he has a decent success there in 1914. And he also notices the two major challenges that the Jews in the United States face when it comes to being a religious Zionist. And what were the two challenges? The first was the power of reform, right? As one Zionist leader tells him, hey, quote, and this is a quote, there's no hope for Orthodox Judaism here in the United States. Now go take a look in 2022 and go back and take a look at that prediction. See how that's come to be. And the second was an economic discussion, as the people were too poor and they were too entrenched in daily living to have time to think beyond their moment or their situation. In other words, the American Jew was way too self-centered to be part of an organization. So diametrically different from what Meir Bar-Ilan was used to in Europe, here he is in the United States of America and he's discovering he's got this great big challenge. But you know what he does about it? He persists. And he says, these are temporary hang-ups, and so you don't give up. So he writes in his little diary, because we have access to that, and he says, they lack organization, but you got to believe that in America you can do for Yahadus. That's his language. In America you can do for Judaism. And he notes that each person alone, whomever he meets along the way, he says, each guy is alone is great and wonderful and fine, right? But, he says, each one of them thinks for himself and about himself. But he believes to himself, each one of these people, Bar-Ilan writes, that his neighbor is really, really not as sincere. In other words, each one of us is sincere. What we would all be thinking to ourselves if we're sitting on this Zoom call right now and we were all talking to Meir Bar-Ilan, each one of us in our own specific windows would be sitting there saying to ourselves, me, I could be a Zionist, but that guy next to me in the next window, she can't be a Zionist because, you know, Nebuch, this is America. That's not the way we operate. And so what happens is Meir Bar-Ilan realizes he has to change this individual outlook. And so he sets out to build the structure of organizing individuals because that's really the change that United States has to go through. We have to leave the idea and the mindset of being individuals and become part of this organized structure. And so prior to World War I, so we're talking about a very short period of time, he starts laying the groundwork for the American Mizrahi Party, and which he did with this conference in 1914. And then he goes back to Europe after a couple of months. But when World War I happens in Europe, he realizes, I'm not in good shape over here in Europe. I'm not going to get too much else done while the whole war is going on. And so in 1915, he decides, gee, I just might as well go back to the United States. And he does. And he lives in the United States for approximately 10 years. And during that time, he becomes the recognized head of the American Mizrahi Party. And while Ha'ivri, the paper that he started in Europe, now becomes defunct, and he restarts it in New York in 1916, in January. And he publishes it until 1921. And it includes such writers who may sound very familiar to you. Maybe you've heard of Shai Agnon, right? Who is a well-known novelist. And Eliezer Ben Yehuda, right? Eliezer Ben Yehuda is in the dictionary, right? Yehuda Leib Maimon. And they're all writing for Ha'ivri. Bar-Ilan also becomes an active member of the Joint. What's the Joint? The Joint was the joint distribution committee where the tzedakahs were sort of organized together and then distributed accordingly to sort of maximize the bang for your buck. In fact, he served as vice president of the Central Relief Committee of New York City in 1916. And again, notice how Bar-Ilan likes to operate. He sees and he creates and he becomes involved in organization, right? And he recognizes that in the United States, to make things work, lots of pieces need to come together to form a whole and a common ground in order for things to be successful here in America. And at the same time, he decides to become the founder of the Mizrahi Teachers Institute, MTI, in 1917, right? MTI will later become known as just TI, which would later become known as Azrieli Graduate School. right? And what is TI, Teachers Institute? Teachers Institute was there to create an environment of developing teachers who would have a Mizrahi attitude and would have a desire to become part of a Zionist background. So the Mizrahi Teachers Institute later becomes part of TI of Yeshiva University, and then it ultimately becomes the graduate school that exists ad hayom hazeh. Now, while we're talking about Mizrahi Teachers Institute and its ultimate merging with Yeshiva University, it would also probably be worthwhile to point out that in its Yeshivas Eitz Chaim, which would later become known as Yeshivas Rabbeinu Yitzchak Elchanan, did not have a president from 1920 to 1922, because Rabbi Bernard Revel, Rabbi Dr. Bernard Revel, needed to go back to Ohio, if I'm not mistaken, to deal with some family issues. And so he took a brief leave of absence from 1920 to 1922. Who served as president of the yeshiva? Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan. You see, and through it all, in addition to the fact that you have to develop an organization, in Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan's head, you also have to go ahead and realize that you need to have education. Education at the young ages leads to the belief in the dream. And so, by 1916, the American branch of Mizrahi has more than 100 local chapters and one massive national office in New York City. And so this goes on until 1923. And in 1923, Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan makes the following decision: I'm moving to Israel. After all, what good are you as a Mizrahiite if you don't ultimately want to go ahead and make Aliyah? We'll talk about that next week, because one of the biggest Mizrahiites never made Aliyah. But in 1923, he moves to Yerushalayim, and in Israel, Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan decides to find another newspaper. And he goes ahead and he makes it a subdivision of the Mizrahi movement, and that's how the newspaper Hatzofeh was born. The founding of the newspaper known as Hatzofeh was a newspaper that was started by Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan and was always supposed to have Mizrahi religious Zionist leanings. At the same time, Rabbi Meir Bar Ilan decides to work on a major project together with Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, and this project, it becomes known as Encyclopedia Talmudit. I'll get to your question in one sec. And so this Encyclopedia Talmudit continues to be worked on today and has become a major issue. And at the same time, Bar Ilan is serving on the board of directors of the Mizrahi Bank. In 1925, he becomes a member of the JNF, and he serves on the board of directors of the JNF, financing the building and rebuilding of Eretz Yisrael under the British mandate. So Tova asks, did Mizrahi start as a philosophy or a political movement? And did it begin in Germany? Excellent question. So we discovered it began in Western Europe. When we did our series on Ukraine, we found that the underpinnings to the Zionist ideology in general began somewhere in near Odessa. But yes, we found that the Zionist movement and Mizrahi started somewhere in Western Europe, right? It began over there as a part of a breakoff, which wasn't supposed to be a breakoff. There was a disagreement within the greater Zionist movement in terms of religious ideology. What had happened was some of the big shots, including some of the greats, Rav Kalischer and some of the others who were involved on a certain grassroots level, they just wanted to have a place where religion was also going to be debated and discussed independent of the general political philosophy. That it should be able to be sort of like a philosophy driver for the practical movement. It would be the liaison d'etre, right? The basis for what we're doing, right? The meaning. Well, it started a counter movement where people like Achad HaAm were also selected to be the secularist head, as we saw in our Ukraine series. So Mizrahi actually started, to answer your question fully, it began as a philosophy within the greater Zionist movement. But it wound up getting splintered off from the movement and became its own, I guess, philosophy and political movement. And yeah, I would say officially it got started in Germany because that's where there was room to go ahead for them to be able to proceed. In 1927, Mar Meir Bar Ilan sees and makes the following declaration. He says that Mizrahi would see the fruits of its labor, not when most Jews are living in Israel, but when Judaism would be seen in most places, but when Judaism would be seen and Zionism would be seen all over Eretz Yisrael. In other words, not when you have most Jews living there, but when Judaism is all over there. So it's not enough to be secularist. You actually, and live in Eretz Yisrael, you need to have a Jewish heart. And so because of this attitude, he realizes it's not enough to sit in yeshiva all day, right? Everyone in the country can't be sitting in yeshiva all day as part of a Zionist movement, right? And so therefore he says, and this attitude comes up, and he says, the farmer has to find God in his farming. The milkman has to find job in his milking. The electrical power plant guy has to be able to find God in his electrical power planting, not to mention the policeman and the fireman and everybody else who's involved. And so because of this attitude, Rav Meir Bar Ilan becomes a big supporter of a subdivision of the Mizrahi movement known as HaPoel HaMizrahi, which is more of the workman's area as opposed to the other side. And he also becomes very popular and becomes very supportive of a youth movement designed not just to be focused on youth that are going to stay in yeshiva, but rather youth who are also going to be involved in growth. And what movement winds up growing out of this? The Bnei Akiva movement. The Bnei Akiva came about, and so to realize the dream of a Jewish Eretz Yisrael, you have to put emphasis on education, and so he fought and he won permission for Mizrahi to establish schools already under the British to establish a school system on its own. And he fought hard to at the same time, to create a better environment for people who are learning Torah all day long, and to raise the standard of the yeshivos as well. And so he sets up a tzedaka organization for them at the same time, known as Mifal HaTorah, and it offers all types of different aid to all different types of yeshiva. He also is credited with the original idea of finding a certain ideology that would later come into play when Rav Chaim Yaakov Golvich, Zecher Tzadik Livracha, Marash Yeshiva in Israel, established a little known yeshiva that became the basis of an ideology known as the Hesder movement. Right, that Karen Biavne was one of the first yeshivot that had a nationalistic orientation and actually had its students serve in the army. And of course, within that regard, the philosopher who set up the environment was Rav Meir Bar Ilan. And he, by the way, was very opposed in 1937 for the partition plan and also the 1939 white paper. In fact, he was very pro civil disobedience and non-cooperation of the Jews with the British. And at the beginning of 1943, Meir Bar Ilan realizes he's got to go back to the United States. He's got more to do over there as well. And so he goes back to the United States, and he has to take a crazy system to get around because it's 1943, and you know what's going on in Europe and in Asia. It's called a little war called World War II. And so he travels to the United States after 6 days of flights from Cairo across North Africa, then to Brazil, then to the United States. And of course, as he gets there and into the United States in 1943, as he lands, word is now out on the street in the United States that Hitler is working through Europe right now, and he's mass murdering Jews all over the place. So the American Jewish leaders decide, well, we need a day of fasting and prayer. We need to have memorial rallies. But by late December and early January, you know what they say to themselves? We've done what we could. So Meir Bar Ilan, American Jews kind of say to themselves, like, wait a minute, we fasted, but is that all, you know, what are we supposed to do? And so to quote one of the newspapers, Der Tag, which was a Yiddish newspaper, you know, they wrote, you know, we fasted, but is that all we can do for the Jews in Hitler land as they walk in the Valley of Shadows? We have to come up with something else for them to do. And Rameir Bar-Ilan says, no, it's not all we can do. And so in February 1943, he decides, I'm going to Washington. And he goes into Washington, and he basically goes by himself, right? He's a one-man lobbying mission to Capitol Hill. And he manages to get meetings with Vice President Henry Wallace, and he gets meetings with leading congressmen and foreign ambassadors to make the case to rescue Jewish refugees and to establish a Jewish state. And his unpublished report of his mission, which he circulates around a whole bunch of other Jewish leaders, kind of scares us when we look at the mood on Capitol Hill as Jewish tragedy is unfolding. Right? So here's what he describes. Rameir Bar-Ilan describes 3 days in Washington, beginning with a meeting with Senate Majority Leader Alvin Barkley, who is a Democrat out of Kentucky. And later he's going to serve as Vice President under Harry S. Truman. And guess what he discovers? Here's Alvin Barkley, and he says, Rameir Bar-Ilan sits with him, and he says, look at the amazing utter silence of the United States government in regard to the situation of the Jews with the Nazis. And he says, take a look in England. In England, numerous members of parliament have been speaking out. He looks at a New York Times report that the Romanian government will cover the permit of the and will permit the emigration of 70,000 Jews as long as you can bring $50 a person to cover transportation expenses. And you know what Rameir Bar-Ilan responds, that the response was? He says, take a look at that. Senator Barkley says, I have no knowledge at all about the above article. And he writes that the Senate Majority Leader was actually pretty unfamiliar with many essential facts and occurrences in Jewish life. And Bar-Ilan asks him about the possibility of the United States absorbing a number of refugees, Barkley says, with the present setup in Congress, there is absolutely no possibility of opening the doors of this country. Again, Barkley, a Democrat, right, claims that anti-immigration sentiment in Congress makes it impossible to bring in more refugees. The real problem, though, is really not coming from Barkley. The real problem was that the Roosevelt administration had created a lot of layers of bureaucratic obstacles to make sure that the immigration quota was way, way, way below. What they were actually letting into the country was way, way below that which they were allowed to have. In other words, during 1942, the quota for immigrants from Germany and Austria went 82% unfulfilled, right? And the quota from Poland, 66% unfilled, which means, think how many lives could have been saved. It's frightening. Frightening. Many lives could have been saved simply by just getting up to the maximum. And yet even the majority leader of the Senate did not even know. The Senate's majority leader didn't know. Well, Rameir Bar-Ilan finishes his meeting with Barkley, and he says to him, I'm a rabbi. If I may, the Jewish people is permeated by an ancient and historical confirmed belief that nations who subjected to torture and persecution sooner or later feel the full measure of God's punishing wrath. At the same time, God sends his blessing to those people who stand by the Jews in their time of peril. This is what he tells Barkley, and this is how he ends his meeting with Barkley. And so what happens? He goes after that to go meet with another senator, this time from New York. He meets with Robert Wagner, not the actor, right? Senator Robert Wagner. And again, he says to Wagner, right? And he says, I can't understand. I'm astonished that nothing practical has been done to help the Jews. And the rabbi says again, I don't understand. And listen to the language he uses, such an important statement. He says, if horses were being slaughtered the way that Jews of Poland are being slaughtered, there would by now be a loud demand for organized action against such cruelty to animals. Somehow, says Rameir Bar-Ilan, when it concerns the Jews, all of a sudden everybody remains silent, including intellectuals and humanitarians of free and enlightened America. Everybody is so silent. Well, let me tell you the rest of the story. 2 years later, General Patton moves United States troops to go ahead and rescue 150 prized Lipizzaner dancing horses, which wound up caught between Allied and Axis forces along the Czech-German border. So Patton was willing to do that for 150 horses. But for 6 million Jews, it's scary. It's scary right there. And so Wagner, who's a senator from the state with the largest concentration of Jewish voters, at best, Bar-Ilan describes his meeting with him as lukewarm. And, you know, again, Wagner blames Congress for blocking immigration and says, I have no influence on the fact that the British have blockaded Israel, Palestine at the time. And he says, let's talk about the status of Jews in the Soviet Union. They're well situated. And I don't understand what he meant by that. So, and not only there, Bar-Ilan goes from there to go meet with Vice President Henry Wallace. And so he begs him to create a Jewish state. He says, Jews are now hoping for the revelation of another Koresh, a second Cyrus, who would be of even greater historical importance than his predecessor, since according to our ancient mystical tradition, the third resurrection of Jewish nationhood is to be forever. And so Bar-Ilan says, look, we are threatened right now with total extinction. And Henry Wallace, the vice president, stops and he says, I can't agree with you on that. End of story. Wallace even refuses to endorse Zionism. Why? Because he knows Reform is very strongly opposed to Zionism. And so he can't go ahead to select Orthodoxy over Reform. And the American Jewish Committee were very opposed. The members of the American Jewish Committee were very opposed to creating a Jewish state. And so Bar-Ilan decides, let me try a different tack. He says, I don't understand. You're the God-appointed liberator of France from the Nazis. And even though you should know that there were many pro-Nazi Frenchmen who are diametrically opposed to America's war against Hitler, how come you won't go ahead and deal with the organization that's diametrically opposed to saving the Jews? So Wallace turns around and you know what he says? It's just not the same thing. Right? And Wallace, when he writes his own story, he has his own diary. And when he talks about meeting Rabbi Bar-Ilan, he says, Rabbi Bar-Ilan asked me point blank for a message which he could take to the Jews in Palestine concerning what I would do for them after the war. I told him with equal frankness that I would not give them any such message. He was very much disappointed, he says of Rabbi Bar-Ilan. I must confess that there are certain types of religious leaders who have a very poor sense of time and place. A poor sense of time and place? Imlo Akshav, Amosai. If not now, then when? And Wallace is walking around Washington, and later that day he starts discussing Rameir Bar-Ilan with Congressman Saul Bloom, who is a Democrat from New York, who supported Roosevelt's administration's position on Zionism. And Bloom tells Wallace that the Zionists were troublemakers, and if you have any more problems from them, like Rameir Bar-Ilan, send them to me. You know where Mayor Bar-Ilan gets some sort of traction? Not with the Democrats. He gets them with the Republicans. One Republican he met, House Minority Leader Joseph Martin, who came from Massachusetts, he says, with tears in my eyes and uncontrolled emotions, the rabbi described the plight of Jews in Hitler's Europe. And Rabbi Bar-Ilan says, you know, when I heard him, and when I spoke with him, the congressman was touched by my words. And Martin screams out, but that's surely wrong. And he says, I'll do whatever's possible to facilitate a congressional resolution about European Jewry. And he says, I'll do my very best to press the British on Palestine. The problem was, Congressman Martin until now had not been approached at all about Zionism or in general Jewish matters. He says, I don't understand. We have a Senate minority. A congressional minority leader, right? I don't understand. How do we, like, not approach him ever? These men have to be furnished with proper material with which to bring home to them some knowledge of our situation. And so although Mayor Bar-Ilan doesn't spell it out, the American Jewish leadership's failure to build ties with the House Minority Leader was motivated primarily by political considerations. You know why? Where are most Jews supporting in the war years? Most Jews are supporting Roosevelt, the New Deal, and the Democratic Party. And so therefore, whom do they lobby with and meet? They lobby and meet with those they have the most in common. Today, we're a little bit smarter than that. Whom do we lobby with? Everybody. always important to remember that we have to meet and try to develop our own situation, not just to focus in one direction. And so in the spring and summer of 1943, Rameir Bialan takes a new role. And he starts getting involved in meetings of two major Jewish coalition groups, the Joint Emergency Committee for European Jewish Affairs and the Emergency Committee for Zionist Affairs. And so within the Jewish community in the United States, he starts pushing from that situation. And, you know, in the transcript of one of the meetings, it says that he complained bitterly about indifference, about inadequate action and lack of feeling for European Jewry. He can't understand the silence of the Jews. Right? He says, maybe what the Jews should do in order to bring light to their plight is perhaps a general shutdown of Jewish-owned stores for, and I quote, maybe a day or half a day or an hour or half an hour, including such important stores as Macy's, Saks, and others, would actually show that to the Jews, as well as to the non-Jews, our sympathy for Jewish victims of Nazi barbarism. At another meeting, he pushes a campaign against the white paper. And so he's stuck. He can't understand the American culture, and he's really frustrated by it. And so the rabbi, Rameir Bar-Ilan, finds himself on the defensive, though, at one point, because Mizrahi decides to open its own lobbying office in 1943. And so at this point in time, there is another Zionist leader, Stephen Weiss, and he was the leading reform and Zionist leader in the United States. And once again, what happens when Mizrahi opens its own office, Weiss sees this as a tremendous, tremendous slap in their faces. And so at a committee meeting of the Emergency Committee for Zionist Affairs, they adopt a resolution condemning Rameir Bar-Ilan and Mizrahi for acting without authorization. And he says they have to close their office right away give the emergency committee a chance to open an office in Washington. Now, on the one hand, this looks a little bit sad. And on the other hand, Mayor Bar-Ilan realizes, hey, look, my opening of my little office in Washington caused this huge Zionist movement that had been hiding away from Washington to realize they had to go ahead and open the office that was so necessary for lobbying efforts. It didn't take a couple of weeks for them to open. It took 6 months, right? And so Mayor Bar-Ilan says, it's amazing to see how long it takes when you have to deal with red tape. Bottom line is, in 1944, he decides, I'm going back to Israel. And at this point, he decides, I'm no longer going to be known as Rameir Berlin. From now on, I'd like to be known as Bar-Ilan. And he has some, you know, when he looks back over his experiences in the United States, let's just put it mildly, he's a little bit bitter about it. And so he speaks about the Bergson Group, which organized rallies to rescue, and it mobilized the famous 400 rabbis who marched to the White House. And he says, although they did a lot to awaken the conscience of the American people, he said the establishment groups worked to undermine the prestige of the activists. And so he certainly spent more time praising the organization and less time on himself, and a way that he was involved in creating a sense of religious Zionism on his own, both outwardly towards Congress and inwardly within the Jewish community. What he does get for his life is the fact that he gets a chance to live till 48. He certainly gets a chance to see the declaration of the Medina, and he gets to rejoice in the issues that come up when a Medina was founded. And there are certain remnants to Rameir Bar-Ilan's life and impact on Eretz Yisrael and Medinat Yisrael. Chief among them, of course, is the university, which is, you know, right outside of Bnei Brak, right, where Bar-Ilan University is located near Tel Aviv. But, you know, many of us know about other certain things, like there's a moshav that's named in honor of Rameir Bar-Ilan. I think we know it as Beit Meir, or Yerushalayim, which is a yeshiva that we send a lot of people to, is located in Beit Meir, where the boys go for the NCSY Summer Kollel. They are sitting right on top of the area dedicated to the memory of Rameir Bar-Ilan. right? And that's where they go. And there's also a forest that's also known as Yar Meir. It's all testament to his contribution. He dies at 69 years old. His legacy lives on in the fact that he really sets a tone for Orthodox Jews to sort of realize that you can do a lot. And you can have a heart. You just have to have a place to believe. And you also can work with everybody. And if there's a room for everybody to work together, great things can be achieved. And so this is the life of Rav Meir Bar Ilan and some of the beginning parts of the idea of creating a religious Zionist movement, both here in the United States, as independent of a religious Zionist movement in Europe. And Be'ezus Hashem, next week, we'll look at the efforts and the philosophical underpinnings and the life and the struggle, particularly, of Rav Soloveitchik when we meet again next week. Everyone have a wonderful Shabbos, and Be'ezus Hashem, we'll see all sorts of great things in the future. Take care. Be well.